Welcome to another episode of the Negative Positives Podcast. And now, I'm your host, Mike Williams. Nah, I'm just goofing with you. I'm drinking cheap-ass beer with the real host, Mike Gutterman. Hey, Gutterman, you're on. All right, folks, we're going to get right to everyone's favorite co-captains, starting all the way out in Los Angeles, California, La La Land, the City of Angels, Mr. Andre Dominguez. How you doing tonight, Andre? Andre? All right, we're going to keep moving to Pennsylvania, or Iceland. No, Virginia. None other than Jess Jones, who is Yessie Ones on Instagram or whatever. And finally, making her third or fourth triumphant return, like a bad penny, all the way from, all the way from Albuquerque, California, Mrs. Roxanna Angles. All right, folks, this first segment's already run a little long, so we're gonna take us a little break so I can water my thorny bush. We will be right back, folks.
Hello, and welcome to the Negative Positives Podcast, episode 388. I'm your host, Mike Gutterman, coming to you from the Gutterman Cave here in Louisville, Kentucky. It's a little milder today. They had really nice, beautiful weather today, but still have a fan blowing on my nether regions because the Gutterman Cave still a little muggy, a little swampy, and but this is a Monday night show. That's my weather report. Got to get that out at the beginning, and so it's a Monday show. We don't have Jess Jones or Roxanna Angles. They could not join us tonight, but we have as usual the gruesome twosome as your captains of the USS Negative Positive tonight. So we'll get to we have a guest as well, which we'll get to, but first we got to get to our co-captain all the way out in Los Angeles, California. La La Land, the City of Angels, Mr. Andre Dominguez. How are you doing tonight, Andre?
Doing well, Mike. We are, you know, a fair way into the worst part weather-wise of the year here in California. The summer, the perpetual summer that everybody seems to want to move here for, and which is the bane of my existence. I, too, have not one but two fans pointed at my nether regions and back. We're going to get through this, but yeah. I hate hot weather, and I don't know how you enjoy it so much.
Love it. I got my flippy-flops on, and it's just everything's airing out. It's perfect, and you'll never hear me complain about the heat, you know, so I'm all for it. But let's say, I guess we got our guest here tonight. Probably got a little heat going on himself, and it's Mr. Larry Effler from Knoxville, Tennessee. Larry, how you doing tonight?
I'm doing well. I just turned my fan off to preserve audio quality. I guess I'll turn it back on.
Audio quality? What is that?
I was gonna say, Larry, you've come to the wrong place if you're expecting audio quality. Here at Negative Positives, we all point fans at our nether regions and just generally reduce the audio quality of the whole podcast because comfort is our number one priority.
Ah, that's much better.
Nice. All right. Well, let it not be said that this show does not have fans, because it definitely does. So,
at least two.
Right. All right. Well, Larry, this is your first time on Negative Positives, and you've been active in the Negative Positives Facebook group, and you've made some appearances on other podcasts. This isn't your first rodeo. You sent some call-ins to us and stuff. So, but for the fine folks out there, why don't you give tell us how you got into this photography madness. It's a question we always have to ask first. So what got you into all this? A little backstory on Mr. F.
Well, I guess I got into photography because my mother did something weird in the 70s for a middle-aged lady. She got a job. Okay. And I was a 10-year-old fourth grader, and she needed somewhere for me to go in the summer, so she took me down to the school where they had a summer program. And if you knew me, you know dodgeball or kayaking weren't going to be my thing. So I hooked up with the photographer, and we had a dark room by the school gym, and we shot 126 film, and we cracked them open, and we developed them. And the first time I saw a print developing in that tray, I was hooked forever. Oh, wow. And then later I got a real camera, a Minolta, and picked up a gig as a photographer in my college newspaper. And that accidentally led to a career in photojournalism and television. And one thing led to another. And now I've got 87 cameras and a very, 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 very bad eBay and shop Goodwill habit. So
nice. Well, there's a lot to digest there. But when you were doing the college paper. Now, I have some experience in that as the yearbook photographer in high school. I was walking around the school with cool guy with a camera, and it turns out I wasn't as cool as I thought. I didn't realize that maybe photographers weren't really deemed the cool guys, but did you in college figure out that the big man on campus with the camera was you the cool guy, or was it like, oh, no, it's the nerdy photographer?
Our job as a photographer for the school paper was two things. Sometimes we covered real news and real sports, but the other thing we had to do was shoot feature pictures, go around the campus and get campus life. And I know you're surprisingly, my trips to shoot campus life always took me to the swimming pool. I don't know why. It was just something that the swimming pool by Sorority Village.
Right. Oh, yeah. I can't imagine what would attract you to that. I mean,
so I was definitely not the big man on campus, but they tell me size doesn't matter. So I spent a lot of time telling folks, hey, I work for the Beacon. Can I take your picture? Sure.
I'm the sure days of me being able to say, hi, I'm taking a photography class. Can I take your picture? Are long gone.
So I'm sure what it was, though. I mean, you were probably using like maybe some ektachrome that really brings out the blues and the blues of the swimming pool. You were thinking color palette, I'm sure.
That was what it was completely. Yeah.
Nice. So you had said in the pre-recording, you also did some worked in television, and which I did as well for 10 years. So we have a little something in common there. But you actually did. You were sort of what you call a photographer for the TV station, which is actually video. But so tell us a little bit about that.
Well, there's always a story with me. I was working at the Beacon, the college newspaper, and I also had a relative who worked at the ABC affiliate in town. And during the World's Fair, he'd always wanted me to come over and visit him. And I didn't want to be the nerdy little cousin who, tagged along with his big cousin. So it took me a couple of years to finally get over there and visit the TV station. Mm-hmm. And I went over there, and he thought there might be a job as a studio camera operator. And it turns out I was sitting there waiting for him to come out, and the news director came out and said, are you the kid from UT, University of Tennessee? Mm-hmm. And I said, yes, I am. He goes, well, I saw your tape, and if you want the job, it's yours.
Wow.
There was no tape. like I said, I was just visiting. So I took a job as a news photographer, had a little TV experience from my elementary school days, which was another story altogether. But I hadn't shot any video, since I was like 9 years old. Mm-hmm. So I got the job as the news photographer, and I told my cousin, the guy who had brought me over, I said, I got a job as a news photographer, and you have until Saturday to teach me how to be one. So he took me out. Then I went back to the Beacon where I was, still shooting for them. And another photographer came in and goes, oh man, I had a double booked. I had an interview at the ABC affiliate, and I had an interview with the NBC affiliate. And I ditched the ABC affiliate and blew them off, and I went to the NBC affiliate instead. And I said, well, guess who didn't? So I got John King's job. And when I got there to sign up, all the paperwork had his name on it and had to scratch his name off and put my name on. So I got some other guy's job in television. And as I said earlier, my first day on the job as a news photographer, I got to fly in a hot air balloon.
Nice.
And my second day, I went to a strip club on the clock. So I was pretty much addicted to news photography by that time.
And this is the job for me, man. Yeah,
it was. And
back in the golden age of TV news.
Yeah, it was way better than the sorority pool. And, I don't want to give the impression I'm some lech. I mean, I am, but I don't want to give that impression. So I started working as a news photographer and did that for a few years and became a news producer and then a promotion producer and all the time shooting. I never gave up shooting a video, and also whenever still photography was required, because I sort of I knew I had a good camera, and I knew how to work the cameras that the station owned. So I was also the guy who took the pictures of the anchors that went on the billboards and the still photos of the ads in the newspapers and those things.
Yeah, that had to be pretty cool when you're driving around town and you see a billboard that you shot the picture for, right?
I got to tell you, the first time you see your work on television is great.
Yeah.
And the first time you see your work 40 feet high above the interstate is just awesome.
Oh, it's got to be. Yeah,
it
is. Yeah.
I mean, it didn't happen often, but when it did, it was just it was a blast to look at.
Did you take any pictures of your pictures? Like did you take a picture of the billboard with your picture?
Well, I took video of the billboard once.
There you go.
As I was shooting a wreck. Back in those days, local TV stations, their motto was "If it bleeds, it leads." So we would cover wrecks, and I covered this car crash, and it was right in one of my billboards, and I made sure that I got that billboard in the shot when I was shooting the the news story.
Nice, well played. Yeah. All right, so did you, when you went to do television video, did you you'd already shot still photography for a while. Like, did you find that translated any? Like, I need to use some rule of thirds here or something to get the dynamic shot of this car wreck or whatever. Or did you ever apply any of your still photography principles to the video that you shot, or did you just go out there and willy nilly just run the video?
Oh no, yeah, the rules of composition still apply. The big problem I had as a still photographer, I would tend to get a good shot, hold it for a long time, and then stop shooting when I first started. Because I found myself shooting a news story as if it were, as I needed one picture. And the first few weeks of my shooting, I ended up not having enough video to cover the stories we covered. But that was my, I got over that pretty soon.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mike, you had, not the exact same situation per se, but you started seeing some of the differences between stills and video when you started shooting Super 8, right? In terms of like, okay, well, how long do I actually stay on this shot for, like trying to come up with some sort of a shot list and thinking of transitions, whereas I think most of us still photographers were like, that's a moment in time and that's a moment in time. And as long as I can come up with a number of them to tell a story. That's even if you're trying to tell a story to begin with. In many cases, we're just trying to get one image that looks good. It's a challenging transition to make, even though there are a lot of similarities between the two.
Sure. I mean, especially with Super 8, it's not cheap. So yeah, you are throwing away dollars every couple of minutes. So I definitely had to think like, okay, I never wanted to hit the shutter on the Super 8 camera more than like, I would count to three or at the most five when I was actually rolling the film. And, it would generally be just quick shots. And it was that sort of MTV style where, really quick, scene cuts. Yeah. But I think, that was a real learning experience. I recommend anybody to give Super 8 a try, because it'll really, keeps you disciplined. Yeah. So, Larry, have you ever shot any motion picture film?
Once or twice we would, when I was in promotion, we would get the budget to shoot on film. It was rare, but I did take a film class in school at the University of Tennessee. And oddly enough, our film instructor was also a sculptor. He said he liked to work in 3D. In the movies, it was the two spatial dimensions in time. And in his sculpture, he worked in three dimensions of space. Mm. But, he was a nerd. I wasn't good at it. I had, When I was a kid, after that first experience in school, my dad bought me a little home movie camera. I was supposed to shoot the family events, and I ended up not because I didn't pay for it, not understanding exactly how much 8mm film cost. I set the camera up on a tripod for Christmas one day and went through 14 rolls of film just
oh no
just with it locked down on the Christmas tree.
Well, yikes. Yeah,
so I had to use my film budget for the next 12 years, so I didn't really get to shoot much.
Right. I will say this, Larry. I'm going to have to ask that you stop mentioning the University of Tennessee. I graduated from the University of Kentucky, so we're a bit of rivals here. So I'm going to have to, this Tennessee talk's going to have to stop.
You know, I'm sorry. I didn't realize there was a university in Kentucky.
Very funny.
I'm sorry. You know, it's funny how we always used to say we would we'd lose in basketball to the Wildcats.
Yeah,
and then we'd say, just wait till football season.
Right.
And now we can't say that anymore.
Well, I don't know. We're still pretty tight in the football. And actually, we've been kind of going back and forth in football and basketball the last couple of years. So I think the rivalry is heated up a little bit. So we're just gonna so that we can continue this conversation, we're just going to forget about that because we might hate each other by
it. Let's.
So, all right. Well, Larry, on your still photography, you know, you'd been shooting since, or at least got into it or got interested as a very, very youngling, I guess. And, so did you always shoot film? Did you go through, the digital phase? Did you dabble in that? Are you just doing both? Or did you come back to film full time? Or where are you at with the film, your journey as far as shooting film and then the digital thing happened? How did all that play out for you?
Well, it was always film early on, obviously. And then when digital started happening, it was about the time I started getting out of shooting photography for a while. Mm-hmm. I never got an autofocus camera even when they were new.
Right.
And I just sort of stopped, and I picked up a little point and shoot Digicam just because, you know, I needed to take pictures of the of family events. I was still expected to do that as being the guy with the camera, mm-hmm. but it kind of became less important to me. And then not to take the room down, but the friend of mine who got me into television, he was killed in a helicopter crash.
Oh.
Yeah, he was doing what he loved. He was shooting video, and he loved shooting arrows. He loved shooting cool and unusual shots, and that's what was happening when the helicopter crashed. And his parents said, asked if there's anything I wanted of his. That, you know, we were really, really good friends, and I had given him a Minolta camera years ago, just as, you know, to get him into still photography. And I said, I'd like to have that, you know, just to have it back to put on a shelf. And they couldn't find it, but they gave me his Canon 10D, which was my first DSLR.
Okay.
And at the time, it was a, you know, a hot new DSLR.
Mm.
And so I kind of I got back into it. I said, "Oh, Mark, you know, Mark the I shouldn't use his name, but he had really good taste, and he had really good taste in cameras, and always bought good gear." And so I had a 10D and two really nice Sigma lenses, and I really got back into it. And that's what got me back into photography as a hobby. And at about the same time, I had changed careers to work for a nonprofit, and a small nonprofit. You can't really hire someone to do everything. So I became the photographer for that organization too. And it sort of brought me back. That was in the early 2010s.
Okay.
And that's sort of when I got back into it. So I got back into it digital, you know. No more film for me. And then another friend of mine, after working at a nonprofit for a couple of years, I learned that her father had owned a camera store in a little town in Tennessee. And I told you
we're not gonna mention Tennessee anymore. I thought we agreed.
I'm sorry, a little town in South Kentucky he owned the camera store in town, and he had dozens and dozens of cameras that people had brought in to repair and didn't pick up. Mm. And he had passed away, and they were going through that stuff, and I was helping their family sort of, you know, establish what was worth something, what wasn't. And I said, if you see it, and my Grail camera when I was a kid was in a Minolta XD11. Mm. So I said, if you see one of those, bring me one. I'll buy it. And they did, and brought it to me, and I fixed it up and started shooting again. And then that's how I got back into film, was there, that awesome. XD11. And I got my old cameras that I still had from, and I never sold a camera. And so all the 35 millimeter and medium format cameras that I ever bought were still somewhere in my house or in my parents' house. So mm-hmm. I found them and got back into it. And that's where I am. That's why I'm still shooting today.
And then almost 100 cameras later, right? So,
Oh, gosh, I wish it were almost 100. I think I can see 100 right now.
When you were shooting, you know, stills for the station back in the film days, what equipment did you use? Did they require medium format for that, given that some of it was going to be for billboards, or was 35 millimeter enough?
No, we used an M645 for the billboards.
Gotcha.
And then I bought an RB67 myself to do that. There was a print shop near the station, and there one day they had a piece of paper in the window that said camera for sale. We're getting a scanner. So I went in, and they had an RB67 on a copy stand that he said it probably had 10 or 15 rolls of film through it, and it never left the copy stand.
Wow.
So I bought it for $57.
Wow.
That was a while ago, but still.
Yeah.
And so I had the RB and shot some anchor billboard shots with the RB67. And then the station also owned a Nikon F3. And that's the Nikon F3 that I did the call and review on. That they had given me a camera case that they didn't have the combination to.
And, I remember that call in. Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, yeah.
And that was an F3 that we finally found in it.
Wow, wow, what a find, man. Yeah, it's funny. Like, you know, you hear people talk about, oh, you know, 35 millimeters just not enough really for big enlargements and all that. But when you talk about it, I mean, you actually did shoot some 35 that went on a billboard. Now, granted, I've heard that billboards, I've never, you know, obviously I've never tried this, but I've heard that if you was to crawl up a billboard tower and get close to the photo, it would look very pixelated apparently. Yeah. Or yeah.
Billboards are low resolution.
Yeah.
They're not really, and digital billboards, which I shoot for those now. And you know, that's, you know, a 10 megapixel picture will work for a digital billboard.
Wow. Because it seemed, but looked at for such a great distance. Yeah. Yeah. Makes sense. Yeah. Okay. Very cool. One other thing is, when you got back into film through that, getting a hold of that Minolta, what time frame was this? Are you getting into the, like 4, 5, 6, 7 years ago, somewhere around there? Is that where we're at?
Just about 2015, yeah, I guess.
Okay. So the film thing, the whole film revival was churning along pretty good, and the cameras were starting to go up in price and everything, right? Mm-hmm. Did you realize that? Did you realize there was this sort of a lot of people returning to film, or did it not matter?
I mean, I saw it. I realized that I could get film at Walgreens again, and I could get film developed at the same camera store that was the big all be all, where everybody got their, you know, Nikons and Hasselblads when I was a kid, was still there. It was a shadow of its former self, but it was still there. Mm-hmm. You know, you could get film processed there. And then I sort of didn't really get into my gear acquisition syndrome didn't kick in until probably 2017 or 18. And then I started buying, I ended up with a free Rolly cord. And
you know what? Your luck is, do you play the lottery very often? Because I feel
it was my father-in-law's camera. So.
Okay. My father-in-law didn't have cool cameras like that. So I'm just saying.
I'd always wanted a Retina Reflex 3. Mm-hmm. And that was back when you could go to KEH and get something like that for $40 or $50. Yeah. I feel like Rip Van Winkle. I was getting all these cameras, you know, during the golden age of cheap film cameras. Mm-hmm. And then COVID came along, and I was trapped on an island. I ended up catching COVID pretty good. I got a good one, and went in the hospital for a month. Yikes. And was sort of unable to do much except lie in bed and stare at the ceiling for another couple of months. And so, and I woke up about in early 2021, and I just started, you know, looking on eBay again. I said, what the heck happened here?
Oh, gosh, yeah, imagine. Yeah.
It's a fun, another funny story that that my wife yells at me about. When I was in the hospital, I was being moved to the ICU, and I was being treated at the hospital my wife, at which my wife was on the nursing staff.
Oh.
And she didn't get to see me, but we talked a lot. She said that you're moving to ICU later today. And I said, well, I've got to call the camera store because my first roll of film through the RB since I'd gotten the seals redone was there at the store, and they said they only keep the film for 14 days. So I have to get the film. She said, you're not going to get the film. You're going to go to the ICU.
You must be thinking, like, get your priorities straight, Larry. Yeah. Jesus. Yeah.
Well, that's what I was telling her. Get your priorities straight. And she still sent me to the intensive care unit.
Wow.
But luckily, they saved my life, and luckily she called and told them not to burn my film.
Yeah, nice. Did was you ever, like, on a ventilator? Was it that bad?
No, not quite. I got within a few hours, and wow. My wife said, "Give him till tomorrow." And I got a little better and a little better. But I was on a BiPAP, which is like a souped-up CPAP, which it's the closest thing to ventilator they can do without sticking a tube down your throat. So
right, right. Wow.
But it was. I'm sorry to, you know, again bring the room down. But
I can't recommend
COVID. Is that right, Andre?
I'm just getting over round three. Thank God mine was not as bad. But having gone through open heart surgery and being in the ICU, and not technically the ICU, but all that stuff, like, I can attest to the fact that perusing eBay and thinking about film cameras to take your mind off of your impending mortality is a very, very therapeutic process.
Well, that's when I found Negative Positives podcast.
Really?
When I was in the after ICU and I was feeling better and just sort of, I was having trouble reading. Somehow being in the I see my eyes were acting up, and that's gotten better. So I was listening to a lot of things. I couldn't even watch, and, you know, hospital cable TV is, you know, not good. So I already had a couple of podcasts. I think I was listening to the Film Photography Project and those, and I just started typing photography podcasts into my podcast engine, and you guys came up, and I started with number one, and I would listen to one of the early ones, and then listen to the latest one, then listen to the early one. And
what a sense of whiplash.
I have to admit that I haven't gotten them all, you know, digested yet, but I'm working on it. You guys keep recommending good podcasts that get in the way. So
we do try to do that. I'm just glad that when you found our podcast, going through what you were going through, you didn't take a turn for the worse because of it. So
well, it just made me realize that life could be worse, and so.
Awesome. All right. Well, I think we got a little bit about Larry here in this first segment. We got some questions from the Facebook group in the next segment. So I think it's about time to take a break. Don't you all think?
I think so.
All right. We'll take us a little break, and we'll be right back, folks. Folks, we're back from the break, and this is the segment where we like to have the fine folks of the Negative Positives Film Photo Podcast Facebook group ask questions of who our guest is, and they always come through and really help us out and come through with the insightful questions that the listeners want to know. So let's find out what's coming from the Facebook group. Andre, what do we got up first?
First up, we have Mr. David Mahaly, none other than the old camera guy himself, saying, "Hey, Larry, I've been digging the results you've gotten with your Agfa Isolette. What prompted you to pick up that old folder and give it a whirl?"
Well, it's always a story with me.
you come to the right podcast.
I work for a nonprofit, and we had a I've never really liked folders before my recent infatuation with them, just because I had one a long, long time ago that didn't work, and it was 100 years old, and it really needed to be on a shelf, not being used. But we had a fundraiser in a little town here in South Kentucky called Clinton, and one of the merchants there had an antique store, and he was complaining because we were closing the street for half an hour. He said nobody's going to be shopping, so I said, well, I'll come over there, and if you've got any old cameras, I'll buy one. So I got there, and all he had was a bunch of old folders, and so I picked out the one I liked the best, which was a Kodak, and So I bought it, and he started to box it up all unfolded and everything. And I said, I'll fold it up and I'll take it with me. I'll put it in my pocket. Don't worry about it. He goes, I don't know how to fold up my camera. I said, what? I don't know how any of these cameras work. And so I got all the cameras out and showed him how to fold them and showed him how the shutter and the iris worked and showed him everything. And so he said that, since he knew how to use them, he could probably sell them better. He gave me a 50% discount on my Kodak. So I shot a little 620 in it, and I loved it, but I just couldn't see myself re-rolling, 120 film. I bought a roll from the film photography store.
Yeah.
And I just didn't want to do that every time I wanted to use it. So I went on the bay and picked up the Isolette just because I wanted one to shoot 120. Mm. And I loved it, and I've always been a square format fan. So I just started using that Isolette, and I just like it a lot. It's I just picked it up for as a whim. It was cheap, and I dig it. It gives me. It's got Mike talks about his magic Holga lens. I think this Isolette has a magic lens. It's just dreamy enough to be dreamy, but not so dreamy that that everything looks like you're shooting it through the bottom of a Coke bottle. So it's just a great lens, and I like it. And I've become a fan of folders, as and the stack of folders beside my computer tells me.
I think that dreamy is actually a really great way of describing it. And I encourage everybody. He'll give his social media at the end of the podcast. But I really do encourage people to check out your Instagram feed, because at least from what I've been able to see, it's super clear to see which ones are the Agfa Isolette ones, because there's a glow and like a bloom around the highlights to everything. With certain images where there's not clearly defining like contemporary subjects in terms of like somebody having their smartphone out or anything like that, this picture could have been taken in the 80s, the 90s, with the look of the film, the color palette, that kind of sort of soft glowiness to the image. I think it's a really, really cool look. And I myself sometimes have to kick myself for putting too much emphasis on sharpness and tonality and all that stuff. It's like, man, sometimes stuff just looks cool. Just because I've never enjoyed the pictures that I've taken out of Holgas or old folders or anything like that doesn't mean that cool pictures can't be made with them. And I think the stuff that you and Mike have created, I think, are great examples of that.
You're hearing this, Larry, the Leica guy is starting to embrace crappy lenses. So I think we're starting to win him over, you know? So
hey, you go old enough with vintage Leica and you're going to run into some crappy lenses.
Dreamy. The word's dreamy. You used it.
True. Dreamy.
Right. I think folders are cool. I don't think I really have anything that's actually considered a folder. I guess the closest thing I would have would be like one of those Polaroid, the land cameras for the pack film. You know, I guess it's technically a folder because of the way it pops out or whatever. I don't know, but I don't think I actually have a film camera, like a roll film camera that's a folder. I think that is one thing that's missing in my collection. But if it's doing dreamy, then maybe I need to be looking into one. So I think they look cool as all get out. I mean, when you're out shooting a folder like that, it's got to get some looks, right? I mean, people got to be
I was shooting at the University of that state south of Kentucky, and it just happened to be there on the day that a lot of folks are out taking their graduation pictures. They had a lot of professional photographers with their DSLRs taking the pictures of the kids throwing their mortar boards in the air and all that. Mm-hmm. I just happened to be there, and I took some really old pictures. I mean, really old looking pictures of the old buildings on campus. And you'll see those in my Instagram feed. And all the photographers started coming over and going, "Look at that cool camera! Hey, let me show." And they all wanted to play with it, so the 20 somethings waiting to get their pictures made were just kind of standing around stomping their little feet.
Nice. Well, you know, you were just slowing down everybody's photography that day. So Nice. All right, Andre, what we got next?
All righty. Up next, we've got Mr. Billy Sanford, host of the Music and Photography podcast, saying, "Can you either confirm or deny the story from The Blind Side that there are body parts buried under the football field at the University of Tennessee? On a more serious note, what's your favorite spot or spots to shoot in the Smoky Mountains?"
Now, I can say things.
We were not going to talk about Tennessee, but I'll allow it on this particular question.
Well, oddly enough, I happen to know a little about that. The story comes from the fact that the anthropology department at the University of Tennessee was housed in the stadium. The stadium was a big brick building that had the bleachers of, like, one set of bleachers. The back of them was a residence hall on one side, and the other side was a bunch of classrooms. And the anthropology department got stashed there when they were just the creepy guys with the bones. So, and I was an anthropology major at the University of the state. And so I spent a lot of time in that stadium with a lot of bones, human bones, non-human primates, everything from lemurs to orangutans. There were stacks of them. They're not there anymore. They're kind of famous now because I don't know if you've heard of the body farm.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, but, okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Being a true crime aficionado myself, I have indeed heard of the body farm.
But the head of the department who started the body farm a few years ago, he's retired now, but he got the anthropology department a little bit bigger, better digs. But during the time frame of the Blind Side, there were a lot of human bones down there, but they weren't buried so much as just filed. But I've sat under the stadium with a human skull in my hand and a pair of calipers measuring it as part of my grade.
Oh, wow. Wow. So not technically actually buried under the football field, but definitely under there in an sterile environment, I guess. Right.
And I guess the more serious question is, where in the Smokies to shoot?
Mm-hmm.
Was that it?
Yes. Favorite spot or spots in the Smoky Mountains to shoot. Well,
like I said, I don't really live in Knoxville. I live in Blount County, which just happens to be the most beautiful spot in the world.
Mm.
Look that up. I'm sure that it's got to say that somewhere. And we are adjacent to the Smoky Mountains. And my favorite place to shoot landscapes of the Smokies is on the Foothills Parkway. It's a fairly recent road that is in the foothills. So you can drive along the Foothills Parkway and shoot pictures of the mountains instead of being in the mountains trying to shoot pictures of the mountains. So you're a couple of miles west, so you can shoot the mountains well in the afternoon when, you know, you don't have to get up at 3 a.m. and hike. You can just drive your car to the first pull-off and wait for beauty to happen in front of you. Now, if you want to shoot wildlife, Cades Cove is a good place. If it's not, it's usually covered in tourists. So if you want to shoot tourists, that's a good place. I recommend. Well,
if you want to shoot tourists, wouldn't you say Gatlinburg Pigeon Forge?
Gatlinburg. Gatlinburg is a great place for photography. If you like your photography in dressed in old timey clothes and holding fake rifles.
Right.
fake rifles. I thought this was Tennessee.
Well, I guess when I say fake rifles, I would say they were decommissioned rifles. But Cades Cove is the most beautiful place, and it's oddly enough, I have a a great-great-grandmother buried in Cades Cove, so I go see her every so often, and then shoot some deer and some bear and some... I mean, I shoot them the way we do now, not the way her relatives did back in the day for the table, but you can always find, you know, bear and deer and other animals. Birds, a lot of birds in the Smokies, and they're coming back. Even in my... I live probably... maybe 15 miles from the nearest entrance to the park in my house. And we have dozens and dozens of different bird species that have just been coming back over the past few years since I have lived here for about 20 years.
Now, there was a big fire in that area recently, right? Like in the last several years ago or something?
Was. It was a huge fire all between Gatlinburg and Pigeon Forge and up over the mountain. It was pretty, I mean, it killed a lot of people. There's still big scars, you know, there are places that you can still see where it was. And,
did you document any of that during that time or was it I always find like everybody asked whether I documented, like the destruction in Mexico Beach when I went there after the hurricane. And honestly, it was just a little bit too depressing for me to even want to do it. You know what I'm saying? Like, but, did you document that or feel the need to?
I've done my stint as photojournalism, so no. I just want to shoot pretty stuff now.
Right. I hear you. Understandable. Yeah.
Do you guys ever feel like kind of pangs of regret for that? Like, I don't necessarily have a geographically based tragedy with which I can express any kind of regret for not documenting, but I look back to my own heart surgery and what an amazing opportunity perhaps to document that extremely important and impactful thing. And at the time, I didn't want to look at any cameras. I got mad at my parents if they took pictures of me in my hospital bed with their phones. But now, like a few years outside of that, I'm like, man, I wish I had documented that. Do you feel anything like that?
Well, it's funny you should mention that. I kind of feel that way about my COVID experience. I'd given myself, I was, you know, getting back into photography and become, you know, but just sort of in a haphazard way and then when 2020 started, I gave myself the assignment. I said, Larry, you're going to post a photo on Facebook and Instagram every single day. Doesn't mean take one. It doesn't mean, you have an assignment that you have to have a photograph for every day on Facebook for the year of 2020. So that was my job for 2020, and everything was going along fine until October 31st when I went in the hospital, and needless to say, I stopped taking pictures. I actually posted one or two while I was in the hospital until I was just too sick to do it and kind of forgotten about it and everything. And what I didn't realize was so many people had found those pictures. And my family and friends from all my different jobs and all my different stations and all my different production companies from all over have been following those photos. And a lot of them sort of figured I was sick because the picture stopped coming.
Oh, wow. And, yeah, I probably scared them a little bit. Yeah, right.
Yeah, it did. You know, and we weren't going to tell everybody that I was in the hospital, A, you know, because, you know, you don't. And B, it's just, you know, our way of saying, hey, guess what? Our house is empty and, you know, and
oh, yeah,
I know you got
point.
A lot of cameras. You know, so, so we never really didn't really tell a lot of people that I was sick until I was better. And but a lot of people figured it out by the fact that the pictures just turned off one day.
Oh, wow.
So I kind of regret not finishing that project. And so in March or April, when I started feeling better again, I started posting a photo or two, and it was like, you know, everybody came out of the woodwork. Oh, we're so glad you're back and all that. And, you know, at first I said, well, I'm not promising I'm going to post a picture every single day, but I have. And now I guess I got to do it the rest of my life.
just so people know you're still okay, right?
Right. It's a proof of life.
that is a description of my personal hell. And this is coming from me being post, like my whole scanning project thing, being excited to post again. The fact that I've been so comfortable to post every day for like a couple weeks straight and then be like, I kind of want to take a break. I couldn't think of something worse than having that like sense of obligation.
Well, I'll allow myself to post digital pictures too. Yeah. So, you know, so that I don't, I'm not going to let it become an assignment to the point where it makes me hate photography. So, yeah, if it does that, yeah. I will tell people I'm not dying, but then I'll quit.
right. Just put up one last post, just a picture of a poster board that you wrote. I'm not dead. I'm just taking a break.
Right. But you know, I mean, I post Facebook, iPhone photos and digital cameras and digital photos. And I do a lot of digital photography with my job with the nonprofit. So, sometimes I find myself taking, pictures for me during that during those assignments. So.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. All right, well, what do we got next, Andre?
All right, next up we have from Mr. Mario Piper, co-host of the Gen X Photography Podcast. I've noticed you taking shots with folders. We mentioned that a little bit earlier. They're great. I've got one, an Ansco Regent. How do you know how to focus, given there's no rangefinder or other way of optically focusing?
Well, two things for that. One is, I got a little laser rangefinder. Mm. And so if you're indoors or close enough,
yes,
you can zap that and it'll tell you how many feet.
Big fan of the laser rangefinder. In fact, I spent way too much money for a Leica one that has a built-in camera.
I buy a lot of Craftsman power tools and stuff, and I just saw that Craftsman sent me an email and they have a laser distance finder now, and I was like, oh, I should get that and show Andre what a working man's laser finder is. Not no fancy Leica stuff, you know.
No. But see, here's the thing, right? Leica's not the only one that has this technology. I mean, you can buy Bosch ones for like $90 that have this feature. But the Leica one, the refresh rate on the little video camera that's in there is much better, so that you can use it outdoors. Because the tricky thing with these laser rangefinders, as I'm sure that you've found out, Larry, is that if you're out and about and it's a bright, sunny day and it's a busy background, you can't see where the laser point
is. Right. It's hard to find the laser.
So being able to look down at the actual screen on the thing and see a crosshair and point it exactly where you want comes in handy. Although, that being said, past a certain amount of distance, shooting at certain apertures, it really doesn't matter. It only matters if you're really trying to, take a shallow depth of field portrait at like 5 feet away is when you really have to, hold the laser rangefinder up to your face and put it at the same focal plane of the camera.
Shoot it right into your subject's eye.
Well, I mean, you tell them to close their eyes, of course, and you point it at their forehead. And the person is like, what the hell are you doing?
I figure if it's too bright and too far away for me to find the laser, I can probably put it on F22 and be okay.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Also, another story. Back when I lived in North Carolina, a good friend and my cousin was a Steadicam operator. Mm. And Steadicam is a device that carries a film or a video camera that you get really smooth walking video. And I assisted for him sometimes. I was his assistant camera operator. And one of my jobs was focus pulling. So I kind of learned to be able to, judge how far away 7.5 feet was or 12 feet. So I kind of learned how to do it. And I get it right a lot now. So sort of I could commune with him a little bit by doing that.
Friend of the show, Peter Planta, who works in the movie industry up in Canada, was actually the one that turned me on to that Leica laser rangefinder specifically, because he worked as a focus puller for a few years. And I can't remember if he got it as a gift or he bought it early on in his career when he first started out as a focus puller. But being able to have that screen on there and use it in any kind of lighting condition, out on set, on location, instead of only on a more darkened soundstage is really what sort of made the Leica one stand out to him. And so after that, I was like, well, I mean, I've got a great review from a dear friend of mine who used it for much more important things than I'm taking pictures of. And it says Leica on it. Sold.
How do you pronounce that?
Leica.
Thank you.
Nice. All right. I guess we got that one answered. So what we got next? Is this our last one, or we got two more?
We got two more.
Awesome.
We got all the podcast hosts today. So we got Wayne Setzer, co-host of the Tennessee-based Shudder Brothers. And I'm sure that – I don't know if what we had mentioned with Wayne was during the podcast or if that was in the off breaks, but maybe Larry will share if it wasn't. Wayne Setzer here, co-host of the Uncle Jonesy's film – Uncle Jonesy's Cameras podcast.
Got it. Nailed it.
Says here, hi Larry, during your early days as a news photographer, did you catch a lot of flack from other photographers for your use of Minolta instead of the more popular Nikons?
Well, here's another story. Well, first of all, what Andre was referring to is that I have discovered that I believe that Wayne and I used to go to the same camera store in Maryville, Tennessee back in the day. By back in the day, I mean like in the 80s. So I think I might know him. We think we might know each other, but not 100% sure. But I think most of my Nikon envy was self-inflicted. But there was this one guy who, just for back when we had two working newspapers in Knoxville at that time, plus every little town had a newspaper. And then I worked for the college newspaper, and we covered real stories, just like, you know, real newspapers. Mm-hmm. But we bought our own gear, and, you know, we were college students. So my gear was at that time was a Minolta X570. And I bought that and an 85 millimeter lens and a 200 millimeter lens and a 50 and a 28. But I was just building my my collection when this happened. And I was assigned to shoot a picture where a disgraced political operative from the Reagan administration was making his first public appearance in East Tennessee, actually in the church that I grew up in, when the first time he'd been out in public since he was fired from whatever job he was in. Mm. And so I was assigned to go shoot that. And we get there, and there were not only were the local newspaper photographers were there, but there were AP photographers and UPI photographers and national newspaper photographers. So we were all in this little place near the front of the church, and they all got out their 200 millimeter and their 400 millimeter F5.6 lenses. And the closest thing I had to a long fast lens was a 135-28 focal brand.
No, Kmart brand, nice.
And Kmart special.
Yes.
And there was no way in hell I was going to get that lens out and put it on my camera. No way in hell. So the best lens I had other than 50 was my Rokar 28. So I shot a wide shot that sort of was a it included the church, and there was this he was on his memory tour, and it was, and if you know Baptist churches, they all say "this do in remembrance of me" on the front. So I put his picture in the context of the church that he was in, and sort of made it an environmental portrait instead of a head and shoulders picture of just another bald guy in a suit. And my picture was picked up by the AP. Awesome. And my picture was ran in all the local papers. So everybody had their tight shots of James Watt was the guy. Everybody had their tight shots of James Watt, but I had a big environmental with him preaching, and it looked like it looked different than everyone else's. So so it was a good thing I was a little punk who wouldn't put his telephoto lens on his camera. So the only flack I caught was from myself, but I'm kind of glad I did on that case.
Sure, and you had to have some pride about that, right? I mean, that's amazing. Yeah.
And it was one of the first pictures I'd had published outside of the the feature pictures. Mm-hmm. And also it was sort of a great time. I got there at the same time Pat Summitt did. So I'm going to.
I'll allow it. I know.
Okay. Thank you. Pat Summitt, you folks know, she's probably the greatest woman's basketball coach, or if not one of the greatest basketball coaches in history. And she created women's basketball basically as a college sport. And she did it at the University of Tennessee. And none of the other photographers wanted to cover women's basketball because it was women's basketball. So I, in that camera store that Wayne and I probably shopped together, I bought an 85 millimeter F1.7 for my Minolta, and I covered a lot of women's basketball. I did it mostly because they serve food to the photographers and reporters at halftime, right. And the women's spread was a whole lot better. And I was a poor college student, so you know, it was a good meal. It wasn't hot dogs and pizza. It was you had to serve it with a spoon, so it was good food. And but I got a lot of good pictures of Pat Summitt's early teams.
Wow, that's awesome. And you know, just to put my little dig in here, Pat Summitt led the Tennessee Volunteers women's basketball team, and actually they did win some championships, unlike the men's basketball team, which never won a national championship. I'm just saying.
This is true.
I just had to put a little dig in there. Yeah. The Kentucky men's team, we won some championships, but just
one or two.
Eight, by the way. But,
yeah, who's counting?
All right. I would allow that Tennessee talk, but I had to put a dig in there. So, but, there you go.
Thank you.
But very cool, man. So, like, I sort of feel you, man. I don't know if you, I think it's really cool that, like, you know, you took these photos on particularly one that got picked up by the AP. I mean, was that Minolta actually considered? Because, you know, there's always these gray areas about whether it's considered a professional camera. Was that particular Minolta considered one of Minolta's professional cameras, or was it prosumer? Or
It was an enthusiast camera at best.
Yeah.
It's not even, it was the step below the X700.
Okay.
I had it because you can meter in manual. The X700, you could shoot in manual, but you couldn't meter in manual. It didn't have a program. And the reason I got it is because it was black, and you know, black cameras shoot. And it was the first camera they had. And it was the first camera they had that would take their 3.5 frames per second motor drive, and I needed that for basketball.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it was, well, it wasn't the first one. It was the cheapest camera that would take their 3.5 frames per second motor drive.
Yeah,
so I've always a good camera or a cheaper camera with a motor drive, and I really needed the motor drive.
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah, I've always felt like this, and one of the reasons I think that, well, besides my dad always shooting Pentax, which is what gave me, I guess, the first allegiance to that brand. But I've always been the guy that just cheered for the little guy. You know, like I always felt like Pentax, Minolta, maybe not so much Olympus, but they were always like definitely the littler guys compared to Nikon and Canon. I've never really, like, identified with Nikon and Canon, because I always, I don't know, I guess I always had this thing about cheering for the underdog, you know?
Yeah.
And, so, and, unless it's Kentucky sports, so, which we're usually not, but there's a thing, like, I think, you know, I remember one time I had to shoot an MMA, like, mixed martial arts fight for my buddy was involved in this organization that was putting on this fight, and he wanted photos taken of the event. And this is in my digital days. And I had my Pentax, you know, DSLR or whatever. And the other photographers there, like from media, all had their Nikons and Canons with the big, you know, the big white lenses or whatever.
Right.
You know, I got some, and he actually liked my photos like better than some of the pro, like more like reporters did. Like I was just doing it as a favor for him, but I got this like the satisfaction that I was the little rebel with the not professional camera there shooting next to all these guys with their, you know, their fancy Canons and Nikons. I got a kick out of that. But
and you know, Minolta had a lot of firsts. They were the first camera with the aperture and shutter priority. They were they had the first working autofocus that really, you know, they really worked. They made medium format cameras. They made 60 millimeter cameras. They made some of the best meters in the world. I think the Minolta flash meters are best. They just never, they were always, you know, I think that the difference between Pentax and Minolta is that Pentax was an underdog and kind of knew it.
Yeah. Okay.
And
yeah.
Minolta, that makes sense. Underdog thought that they deserve to be up there, but why aren't we?
right. That makes sense. That's a good analogy. Well, one of the questions I had about, you mentioned, you know, we talked about the getting the photo picked up by the AP. Now you're obviously on staff or for several papers at that time or whatever, but like, do you get like money from that? Like the AP picks up your photo. Do they pay you like for that photo? Is it anything to talk? I mean, did you get a good payout for it? Is it like, or you just get the or it's like, you know what, you getting credit for this photo is enough. You know, that's
no money for it from the AP, the newspaper. And well, the AP, the folks who shoot for the AP get paid, but if you're a local paper and you're, this is the way it was then, and your picture is picked up, it's part of the dues of being that. That's what your paper, the reason your paper can use photos the other 364 days a year is that one, you know, there's a chance that they might need one from you at one point. So, but when I work for the TV station, if my video got picked up by ABC, you did get paid. And that was always sweet.
Okay, but that's cool. Okay, that makes sense. Yeah.
AP, you just, at least that's the way it was for the college paper.
Yeah.
The professional papers may have had a different deal, but either that or someone cheated me out of my $78.
But when your photo appeared in like AP publications, did it at least give you credit for it?
Yeah, it had my name.
Awesome. I guess that's something, you know. So, but
when you're a college student and you think you're going to be the next a photojournalist's name escapes me right now, but if you think you're going to save the world with your camera, you know, that's right. All you need.
Yeah, sure, makes sense. All right, what we got next, Andre?
All righty, final one. We've got Miss Sherry Christensen, co-host of the Embrace the Grain podcast, asks here, tell us about your Frugal Film Project 2022 camera, the often overlooked Canon T80. Are you loving it? You've had some pretty great shots so far. What are some of the quirks you've found with it?
Oh, man, that camera and that whole project, there's no way in the world I would have picked up a Canon T80, except that I had to find a camera that was less than $50, and this one crossed my path, and I had just been gifted a Canon AE-1. Another story. No, I'm not gonna tell another story. But my brother-in-law had just given me his Canon AE-1 from
again. You should play the lottery every week.
and I felt guilty about using that one because it's not a a cheap camera. It's a nice camera that just happened to have a $0 price tag for me. Mm. So I bought this $25. It was, I don't know if you guys know what the Canon T80 looks like, but
I've seen
imagine
that. Yeah.
Imagine what's the a kit car? The was that his name from the talking car from
Knight Rider. Yeah.
Yeah, Kit from Knight Rider. Imagine if that had been made by Toyota. That's what this camera looks like. It's all angles and 1980s. And
yes.
It had an autofocus. You could get an autofocus 50 for it. And since the camera was so cheap, I decided to do the Frugal Film Project as a to see how many things I could buy, how many cheap things I could buy and attach to this camera for the $75 limit. So I got the camera, and then for my camera, so I got a off-brand 28mm 2.8 lens that really shoots pretty well. It's a Tokina. I mean, it's not that far off-brand. And it was $6.50. I got a Vivitar 200mm f2.8 FD mount lens for $11, I'm thinking. And I got the finally got the 50mm autofocus lens that is, I mean, for the world's first autofocus SLR, I mean, it's pretty good, you know.
Yeah.
It does the job. But the camera is really weird. It's got a split image rangefinder that has vertical and horizontal lines.
That's nice. Yeah.
Yeah. And the one thing about this camera is it's a program camera. It doesn't you can't set. There's no aperture priority. There's no shutter priority. It's you take what Canon gives you. And if you don't like that, you can, you know, go to the sports mode and get a faster shutter speed, or you go to the depth of field mode and get a slower shutter speed. But you know, by the time that you do that, you know, the bug you wanted to shoot is gone. It's flown away. So I'm shooting Foma Pan 200. not my favorite film, but it's Frugal. And I think I have gotten some pretty good pictures. And it, like I said, I would never have picked this camera up on purpose, but because it's I've assigned myself to shoot a roll of film every month, and also I have that assignment where I've given myself the assignment to post a photo every single day. Those things work together, so probably more of my photos in 2021 will have come from that camera than any other single camera because I've given myself that assignment. And right. I think I've got some pretty good nature pictures and some landscapes and just the kind of things that you know that you would have taken with that camera in the 80s when it was new.
Yeah, that's a great description of that camera, the kit from Knight Rider, made by Toyota. I feel like that describes exactly one of my favorite cameras is my Pentax SF1N. It's the same thing from the 80s, like really angular, like lots of sharp lines and stuff. Definitely from the 80s. I always thought it looked like something from a Terminator movie or something, but I think your description is a little better. But I actually bought that camera to get involved in some of the Sunny 16 cheap shots challenge. Cause I actually picked up that at a local camera store for like a little over $20. And it's a fantastic camera. It's ugly as sin. It's definitely from the '80s. But yeah. And honestly, like it's actually was so capable that I actually felt like I was kind of cheating on the cheap shots challenge a little bit, you know, because that one does offer like aperture priority and stuff, but, and also it has some program modes as well, but it definitely has that angular 80s look, which I actually kind of like now. Like, honestly, I feel like those cameras should be coming back in style at this point, right? I mean, everybody's... Yeah.
But I'll tell you, having no control of the camera was getting old there. So in January and February, it was a novelty. Mm. In March, I was thinking, boy, you know, I really wish this camera would break. Because, you know, there's no fixing it. It's all, you know...
Right. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Circuit boards. So when it does break, I can convince, but it's probably going to last forever because it hates me.
Nice. Andre, do you have any cameras that you would describe as ugly that you love?
Ugly, but I love.
You're such a, you know, classic Leica guy. Do you have any ugly cameras? Like, it's not like a classic looking.
I don't think so, man. I mean, like the most kind of quirky is probably the Chroma Snapshot. I would not at all say that it's ugly, but it definitely has a non-traditional silhouette that when people look at it, they're like, "What the hell are you shooting?" Especially with like the. the spacer bars that separate the rear and front standard that look like literally they're parts, you know, out of a from a hardware store, and then the little pancake 90 millimeter lens on it and the cable release that goes from the lens that, you know, sort of feeds through the 3D printed handle, it definitely sticks out as something where it's like, that's weird, what is that?
Mike, you have to realize anyone who'd use the phrase non-traditional silhouette doesn't get what we're talking about.
Well, Andre, don't you still have an Ethan Moses camera? Do you have a camera dactyl of some sort?
I technically do. I haven't used it in a while. It was giving me a few issues.
No, Ethan, that's got to be at least, I'm not saying ugly, but definitely non-traditional, right?
Hey, function over form.
Right. Awesome. All right. Did we get through all the questions?
We did.
Awesome. Well, thanks everyone for the from the Facebook group, the Negative Positive Film Photo Podcast Facebook group, for the excellent questions. And I think it's about time for us to take another break. I've got enough beers into me where it's time to water that thorny bush again. And then let's we're going to come back, and Andre and I are going to follow up with some questions to Mr. Larry Effler. Larry, it's funny because Larry said before we started recording that, you know, he is no way he could be entertaining for three segments. And I think he's proven us wrong. Right, Andre?
I mean, I don't think that there have been people who have underestimated their entertainment value as much as Larry.
All right.
Thank folks. You. You're welcome.
All right, folks, we will take us a break and we'll be right back. All right, folks, we're back for the final segment, and this is where Andre and I are going to follow up with Mr. Larry Affler and with some questions that we just felt like we wanted to get out there. So I'm going to start off. Larry, you've mentioned several times throughout this episode that you are involved in a nonprofit, and so and that you also do some photography for them for whatever needs they may have in that. But so I just wanted to hear a little bit about that, give you a chance to promote that, and maybe get some knowledge out there about that, and tell the people what you're doing with it, and how even maybe how you use photography to help it out as well. So.
Well, thank you. I'm going to have to mention that state that lives south of Kentucky.
Okay.
I work for a nonprofit called Alzheimer's Tennessee. It's a local nonprofit that we serve the whole state of Tennessee and a little bit of Western Virginia, right there near Bristol. It's an organization that was founded in 1983. It's not the association. We were part of the Alzheimer's Association for a while, and then several years ago, we became a separate Tennessee-based organization. Our mission is to help the people who have Alzheimer's now and their families. Mm. Alzheimer's is a disease the whole family has it. The whole family lives with it.
Yes.
The whole family suffers from it. So our effort is to make it so that the people who care for the people with Alzheimer's can maintain their health, maintain their sanity, and maintain a good lifestyle so that they don't. And, you know, so many times people with Alzheimer's, the caregiver ends up dying before the person with the disease because caring for someone with Alzheimer's is so exhausting and so time-consuming.
Wow.
So that's what we do. We educate family caregivers to be able to do their awesome job without killing themselves. We help them do it. We help them find resources. We help them find respite care. And when COVID happened, it turns out that my experience in television had helped out. We would normally do all these support groups and these training scenarios in person, but we couldn't. You can't get, 2,000 people together to breathe on each other anymore. At least you couldn't, in 2020 and 2021. Thank you. Mm-hmm. So we turned our conference room into a TV studio. We got some grants from the Pat Summit Foundation, and got some camera gear and built a little TV studio. So we were able to continue doing our projects, continue doing our mission over Zoom, and Pat Summit.
She had Alzheimer's, didn't she?
She had early onset Alzheimer's. That's what killed her. That's what ended her career also.
Wow.
And
wow.
Her foundation is in Knoxville, and our home base is in Knoxville. And we work together with that organization a lot. And what we say is one day there'll be a cure for Alzheimer's, but until then, there are millions of people who need care. And that's what we do now. And, we do our fundraisers and those sort of things. So I use my photography skills for that. I run the websites and the social media sites. So I do most of the photography you see there. And it lets me use my hobby for something good. And I really feel like after in my older age, I finally, after all those years of working in television, I finally found what I was meant to do. Now, they almost never send me up in a hot air balloon or to a strip club, but I can live with that.
right. Well, that's an awesome, awesome story. And thank you for what you're doing there. And God bless you for it, man. Like,
let me say one more thing.
I'm sure. Yeah, go ahead.
ALZTennessee.org.
ALZTennessee.org.
Okay. ALZTennessee.org is our website. Okay. Anybody out there, if you live in Tennessee, we can help you. If you live anywhere in the world, we can help you. Give us, look us up, give us a call. If you don't live in Tennessee, we can find the organization where you do live that can help you. And please, that's what we're there for. We're there to help you in this tough time. So it's ALZTennessee.org.
Awesome. That, man, just super, super cool of you, man. I can't think of a better, to think of everything you've done with your photography. Is that maybe the most important thing you feel like you've been able to use photography for? Surely, right?
Oh, easy. Yes. And Mike, we have used some of your music in some of our video productions.
That's right. I remember you reaching out to me about that and asking for permission. I was like, are you serious? You absolutely have my permission for that. I'd be honored by it. Yeah. That's awesome, man. I appreciate that. That makes me feel really good that somebody was able to use it for a good cause like that. That's awesome, man. I appreciate that. Yeah.
You were on TV in Knoxville and in Bristol.
Wow. Oh, that is so cool. I didn't know that. I didn't know it reached that far, but man, to think that somebody used it for something that, such a wonderful, cause thank you, Larry. That blows me away. I appreciate that.
Of course. Thank you.
Awesome. Well, Andre, you got any follow-up to that, or you want to go into your question?
Well, I mean, I really wish I went first.
Mike, I need to cut these.
Yeah, Mike, do me a favor and just re-edit this to where I'm starting out the part three Q&A. That would be great. Thanks so much, man. I really appreciate it.
you know I'm not going to do that. But,
I know you're not going to do that. But no, again, thank you so much for the work that you do, Larry. It's really, really great that you've found a way to leverage your career and your skills and your hobby of photography for something so impactful. I'm now going to ask a very petty question and a very self-serving question to contrast Mike's altruism. I don't know. It depends on how you look at this question, but I think it's inevitable to come to the conclusion that photography and videography changed completely when the move over from digital to film happened. You're working in a different area and in a different industry than you were at the start of your career. But how have you seen the kind of growth of digital and the fact that now even the smartphone is the primary way that most people, even in the photojournalism world, which has become much more democratized, has become the primary method of still image and video capture, changed what that career looks like, what the industry looks like, and sort of what are some of the impacts on that?
Well, I'll tell you, you may have forced me to go philosophical here.
So see, Andre, it was a good question. See,
I didn't think it was a bad question. I just didn't want to follow you after yours after I knew what it was about.
When I started in television, it was just before everybody had a home video camera. Mm-hmm. And it was just before then. And we had the old timers who taught me the business. And this guy's great. He's just the best. He's a video engineer. He knew how to do everything in the station. And one day, one of our clients, when we were doing a commercial, asked for the commercial on VHS so he could take it home and show it to his family. Mm-hmm. And Ray said, "This is going to be the end of our business, because now instead of us TV professionals being the expert, it's everybody's Aunt Edna." And, that is how I think the business has changed. I mean it's democratized production immensely. My first TV camera, the gear that I carried on my shoulder and brought into my house, tripled the value of my house when I brought it inside. It was that expensive.
Yeah.
I had about $500,000, about $250,000 worth of TV gear. And now at the nonprofit, we have much more capable gear that that cost $5,000 for everything that we needed, and that's including two cameras, lighting, a switcher, everything we needed to take our shows on the road. Mm. And so I think that the way the business has changed is that you don't have to be a professional. And that means that you don't think it takes a professional.
Ah, man, that's a good point. Yeah, good. Well said. Yeah, makes sense.
Good. I mean, you look on YouTube and you see, so much great stuff being done. Mm-hmm. And you see a bunch of stuff that's not great being done. And everybody has the same access. And I'm not saying that's bad. I'm just saying that's the way it is. I use videotape, and frankly, the transition from analog videotape to digital video wasn't the big change that the still photographers experienced. They went from using film that you had to rush back to the newspaper and dunk your film and and dry it and print it and paste it up to, you know, handing a to, well, to emailing a picture to the, you know, to the office. That their workflow and their business changed a lot, and a lot more than our than video did. Mm-hmm. But the just the fact that, yeah, I'm gonna go with my statement. I think my profundity will end with just because you don't have to be professional means you don't think it takes one. But you know, to do it right, it does. Whether you're, you know, that doesn't mean you have to go to college to learn to do it, but it does mean you have to get good at it before you can make a big difference.
Yeah, I've
been watching Lucy Lumen's video channel get so much better.
And, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. As you know, as it's just been a joy to watch her. You know, I mean, I watched that improvement just over the past. You know, it didn't take long, but mm-hmm. You could tell she started before, and you could tell before she started, she did a lot before. A lot. I'm sure there's a lot of things we didn't see.
<You know? laughs> Right. Right. Unlike this podcast where I let it all out and probably should have held back at the beginning a little bit, you know.
Like, well, you know, Mike, maybe that makes the improvement so much more visible because people saw how much of a shit show it was at the beginning, and now it's like we're a semi competent podcast.
That's questionable.
I want to tell you, when I was sitting in the hospital, my oxygen levels were below 80. It sounded all right.
There we go. The standards, people. When you're struggling for oxygen, you know, our early episodes sound all right.
they kept me alive because, you know, you didn't want the last thing you heard in your lifetime to be Thorny Bush.
Oh man, Thorny Bush, a bunch of horrible dad jokes. It's like, well, if this is this is how I go out.
That's it. You know what? I'll take that as a compliment. You know, I'm gonna run with it. But
I'm sorry.
No, negative pauses. We're not the last thing you want to hear in your life, and that might be our new tagline.
Larry, there's no better way to ingratiate yourselves with the hosts of the negative the co-hosts of the negative podcast, negative positives pod. I'm about 5 beers in, so then gently ribbing us. So okay. well done on your first appearance on the podcast. You've passed with flying colors. We look forward to a similarly engaging future roundtable episode.
Oh, that, absolutely. Yeah.
That does remind me that I'm really concerned about all the discussion about folders because it had an L and a D in it.
You know what? You know what, Larry? You might be pushing the envelope a little too far now.
Okay. I'm joking. Okay, I just wanted to know where to set my limits.
I'm joking.
I think we have like one of those parental those little black and white parental advisory sticker, the podcast equivalent of those little black and white parental advisory stickers on on the podcast, don't we, Mike? Isn't it technically rated 18 plus?
I just put explicit. I don't, there we go. Yeah.
I wasn't sure what the terminology was.
Yeah. Looking back, I think we've been pretty good tonight.
I think we have. Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes it's in the subtlety of the raunchiness.
Right.
You know, it's really under the radar. It's in the subtext, the reading between the lines.
I call them all explicit because I just don't want to be. Even I've had many episodes where there's been no curse words or anything, and like I just put them all explicit because I just like, did I miss one? Like I just right. You know, it's just easier that way. You know, but which the bad thing is, I always wonder when like people are looking at the podcast feed or whatever, and they see negative positives film photography podcast, and it's marked explicit. Like, does some people just not listen? Because like, I don't want to listen to a bunch of raunchy people talking about, you know. But like, I just do it to kind of CYA. I'm gonna I,
raunchy cover. Self-help.
The CY, cover your ass. So there you go. I said a cuss word, so now I gotta put it explicit now. So there you go.
Well, I think you know, the mentions of strip clubs before probably, you know, dinged us on the algorithm or something.
right. Well, Larry, it has been an honor and a pleasure to have you on here tonight, man. It's been a lot of fun, and just thank you so much for spending some time with us, man. I know that these recordings go a little long, and I don't know what time you have to get up in the morning or anything, but I appreciate you spending some of your time with us.
Well, thank you. I have to start a podcast at 8 a.m, so I'm gonna crash.
Well, I've got one last question.
I'm sorry, I have to start a webinar at 8 a.m. I'm sorry.
I hear that.
I thought we were so inspiring that you were gonna start another podcast.
I'm sorry. I have to start a webinar at 8 a.m.
That affects the last question I was gonna answer. I guess that now I've got to kind of change gears a little bit, but just kidding. One last thing that I wanted to kind of ask you, and I'm ashamed that I don't ask this of more first time guests whenever they come on, but you know, you have the unique experience of not too long ago jumping into the Negative Positives universe in a very unique way of listening to the super early stuff and the contemporary stuff both at the same time while trying not to die. We haven't quite gotten that perspective before. So now that you've been on the back end of things, you've listened to the conversations and the breaks between the things, the stuff that we don't publish, the raunchy jokes, the deep probing, perceptive, emotional ones. What has been overall your impression of the Negative Positives podcast, and has it changed being on the other side of it as a guest versus a listener?
Well, at the risk of not being mean enough, I've had a really, really, really good time. This has been a blast. You two are a joy to talk to, and I think you bring out the best in the people who are talking to you. And no kidding, folks out there in Negative Positive land, these are great guys. I don't care what it sounds like when they're.
Oh shucks. Well, okay, I'll turn this into a promotional activity, because I know that Mike recently, I've not been super active on the Facebook community recently, the Facebook group, sorry, I should say, but I saw that Mike put out a post as sort of a call out for, instead of call-ins, a call out for future guests, whether that's, you know, hey, remind me if I've mentioned that I'll have you on the podcast in the past, or if we've never talked about it, please indicate your interest in being a guest. We really do want to emphasize the fact that you don't have to be some film photography community celebrity. You don't have to think that you have something unique and important to say. Mike and I are, I mean, granted, goobers. I then went, we're absolutely goobers, but I then went to go and work in the industry, but let's forget about that part. We both, when we were initially in the early stages of the podcast, we were just two nerds that loved film photography, loved the community, and thought that we had something to say, even if it was dumb and stupid and full of dad jokes. So anybody who has ever thought that, you know, I don't have anything important to say, I'm not important enough to be on a podcast, you know, fooey to all that. The vast majority of guests that we have on the Negative Positive podcast are your average Joes and James, who Mike and I relate to more than the big names. So please, if you have any interest in coming on the podcast, sharing your unique perspective, send us a message, you know, indicate your interest. We pull a lot of our guests from people that interact with us on social media, be that Instagram or especially the Facebook group. Please reach out to us. And again, I will use this opportunity to specifically call out, you know, our not non-existent female listenership. We know that you are out there. We know, unfortunately, that you do not participate in and engage with us on some of these platforms as much as some of the men folk do. Please reach out to us. I think it would be great to have you on the podcast.
And can ladies, you, they really are gentlemen.
I don't know about that.
I mean, they won't hurt you.
Can you tell Andre's been drinking, Larry?
People who've been listening to recent episodes of the podcast are like, wow, Andre's so much more spirited and uninhibited today.
My only experience with Andre, of course, is the podcast, so he just sounds normal to me.
Well, Larry, I think you would be the first one to admit that it is a very clear difference between the episodes where it's been a hard Monday, you know. I've been yelled at by a lot of people in Cinestill customer service. I've not been able to control a whole lot of, like, international shipping things, and it's just been a rough day, and I'm just doing my best through the podcast versus the day where I had a great day. You know, I got some food in me, I've got some beer in me, and we've got a great guest.
This was just a great conversation, and I mean, no kidding, folks. It really was just a blast and a half. And
awesome.
It is well past midnight where I live, and I have to be up in 6 hours, and I'm still having a great time.
Yes. So with that, I will stop my love rant. I will, you know, transition us towards the latter half of the podcast. Mike, let's close this out on a high note.
Yes, sir. Oh, thank you, Larry, so much. And yeah, I always love Andre's alcohol driven love rants. But yeah, it's time to get you in bed, man. So Larry, again, thanks for coming on. And how about you tell the fine folks where they can check you out?
Well, I think I may have mentioned alztennessee.org if you want to see my work. My Instagram handle is very imaginative. It's Larry Effler.
That's the way it should be. Yeah.
And I'm also on Facebook.
Awesome. Awesome. And Mr. Andre, where can people find you?
People can find my revived, renewed, refreshed Instagram account at AndreOnFilm.
Awesome. You can find me on Instagram at GuttermanPhoto. You can email this program, negpositives@gmail.com. That's negpositives@gmail.com. You can join the Facebook group, the Negative Positives Film Photo Podcast Facebook group. We also have an Instagram account, Negative Positives. If you submit photos to Instagram, think about using that hashtag, Negative Positives, and maybe I'll see it and highlight it for everyone to check out. I'm trying to do that. I've been wanting to do it more than I have, but you know, every once in a while, I'll pop up some, you know, I put a little spotlight on you. So think about using that hashtag if you're on Instagram. You can support this program on Ko-Fi, ko-fi.com/negativepositives. Let's see. You can get my music on Bandcamp. It's mikegutterman.bandcamp.com. Just came out with a little electronic album in the last week or so. A little Boots and Cats. Boots and Cats and Boots and Cats type music. So if you need some electronic music for your productions, it's out there. And it's free and available for anyone to use under a Creative Commons license. So again, thanks to Mr. Larry Effler for joining us tonight. It's a lot of fun, and can't wait to have him back on for a roundtable discussion or for whatever reason we might need some spirited conversation. So, all right, folks, everyone have a good couple weeks. We'll be back, I believe, with I guess it'll be a host show coming up next, a listener interaction show. So until we talk to you again, everybody stay positive.
Shoot some cool film photos.
There it is, man, right on the spot. Like, you know, that's a guy that's done some production in his life, you know, like he's right there on the spot. So all right, folks, we'll talk to you soon. Take care. Gutter Man Cave Production!